Asian, a Native, who are saying, we are not going to accept just an infrastructure plan that fixes our roads and our bridges while you leave our bodies, our education, the infrastructure of our daily lives, living wages undone. We can't do that. And we're saying, if you oppose the PLP, small as it is, then you also oppose racial equity, and you also oppose class equity. And we have to start unpacking these deals.
Reverend Garber, we have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us. Co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach. And a fond farewell to Miriam Barnard. Such enormous gratitude for all your work over the past decade. Special thank you for helping to keep our team safe on and off-site during the pandemic. Your humor and compassion and skill was so cherished at Democracy Now! You'll be forever a part of our DNA, because, after all, you are a Democracy Now! Alum. All the very best. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
This is Constance Sharp of Rock to Recovery and co-author of the book Rock to Recovery: Music as a Catalyst for Human Transformation with Les Gear, asking you to tune in to KBOO on Monday, November 22nd at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Public Schools Board will not vote tomorrow on a student vaccine mandate. A Multnomah County judge orders Portland police to turn over internal numbers corresponding to 2020 protest officers, and attorneys make their closing arguments in the criminal trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 15th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon COVID-19 cases hit a 15-week low on Friday. The state reported the lowest total number of cases since the end of July. Additionally, hospitalizations are down below 500 for the first time in Oregon since August 7th. The two-day report from the Oregon Health Authority showed 1,811 new cases in 33 counties. That brings the cumulative state total to 378,174. Oregon health officials also reported another 20 deaths, raising the state's death toll to 4,774. Friday's OHA report showed 71% of new COVID cases in the previous week were among the unvaccinated. Of the nearly 40,000 total breakthrough cases in Oregon, only 4.4% of people have been hospitalized and only 1.1% have died. Unvaccinated people are four times more likely to contract COVID-19 than those who are vaccinated. The Portland Public School Board will not be voting on Tuesday on a COVID vaccine mandate for students as they had originally planned. Instead, the board will hear staff recommendation to delay the vaccine requirement for at least 6 months. This means the board is not expected to vote or take action on a vaccine mandate for students anytime soon. However, a discussion of the mandate is still on the agenda. Some students have expressed support for a vaccine mandate. Last week, the PPS District Student Council, a group of students from PPS High School, voted unanimously to support a vaccine mandate for students. It will be up to the board to decide whether to take up the issue of student vaccine mandates again. On Friday, the Burgerville Workers Union announced that organizers had reached a tentative agreement with Burgerville management. The union is the country's only federally recognized fast food union and has spent more than 3 years in contract negotiations with Burgerville. The fast food chain's employees have faced much pushback from the company, including anti-union messaging, targeted firings, and even a ban on Black Lives Matter buttons. The union announced on Friday that organizers had reached a tentative contract agreement with Burgerville management. This means union members need only vote to ratify the agreement, and then their long-negotiated contract is final. Workers at only 5 Burgerville locations are members of the union, as each location held separate votes to unionize, so just around 100 workers will be covered by this contract. However, during negotiations, Burgerville unilaterally adopted many policies proposed by the union, like allowing employees to collect tips, increasing wages, and providing staff with a free shift meal. While those policies are also codified in the contract, they'll still benefit workers who are not a part of the union. The proposed contract also increases the number of paid worker holidays from 0 to 5, allows for a more reliable work schedule, and does away with at-will employment, or the ability for a company to fire a worker without reason. Union members will vote to ratify the proposed contract over the next several weeks, and those votes should be final by mid-December. There's still a chance union members will not vote to ratify the contract and instead will push for more adjustments. However, union leaders say this is not a likely outcome. If approved, the contract will last until the end of April 2023. A Multnomah County Circuit judge ruled last week that the City of Portland must turn over the entire list of internal personnel numbers that correspond to the identities of Portland police officers. The ruling follows an earlier decision that granted partial disclosure of officers' names. Portland Police Bureau command staff had authorized officers to cover their name tags on their uniforms and instead use numbered pieces of tape as a means of identification. The Bureau said that officers on the rapid response team who were present at the 2020 racial justice protests feared activists would use their names to publicly release their personal information. Alan Kessler, a public interest lawyer and political activist, filed a public records request in June 2020 for a document that would allow observers to match the numbers on officers' uniforms to their names. Kessler said he wanted members of the public to be able to identify officers who they thought might be using excessive force on protesters. Without the officers' names, filing complaints would be a waste of time. The City of Portland rejected his request, and the Multnomah County District Attorney upheld that denial on appeal. Kessler then sued the city in Multnomah County Circuit Court, appealing the DA's denial. Multnomah County Judge Pro Tem Terrence Thatcher took a different view on the issue. Thatcher noticed there were 2 sets of numbers that officers could put on their uniforms, a 6- or 7-digit number called a PHR number that the city assigns to all employees, or a 2-digit number assigned to all members of the rapid response team. The judge ordered the city to turn over a list of the 2-digit numbers assigned to all members of the rapid response team, as the longer number is linked to personal information such as salary, home address, and social security numbers. However, after his initial ruling, Thatcher then reviewed Kessler's original request for the 6- to 7-digit PHR numbers. The judge did not accept the city's argument on that front either, that revealing those numbers would compromise officers' safety since the personal information in each employee's file is still protected by passwords and other computer security measures. Thatcher then ordered the city to turn over the second list of officer names. The judge wrote, quote, "The city must divulge the documents sought by Mr. Kessler showing officer names and associated PHR numbers." City Attorney Robert Taylor declined to comment, saying that his office is assessing the judge's ruling. Prosecutors and defense attorneys made their closing arguments today in the criminal trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the 18-year-old who is charged with homicide after fatally shooting two protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The prosecution and defense have both rested their cases in the Kenosha shooter homicide trial. Closing arguments are underway. Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber and injured Gage Grosskreutz at a protest in August 2020. Rittenhouse is standing trial for two murder charges and an attempted murder charge, as well as illegal possession of a dangerous weapon. He has pled not guilty to the charges and says the three people he shot were in self-defense. Charges could carry a life sentence in prison if Rittenhouse is found guilty. There were protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in the wake of the August 2020 police shooting of Jacob Blake. Blake was shot in the back by police seven times in front of his three sons. The Blake shooting highlighted racial inequities in Kenosha, Wisconsin. One-third of black people in Kenosha County live in poverty. 40% of adult black men are jobless, and black people are incarcerated at a rate 12-fold higher than whites. Kenosha experienced widespread unrest in the days after Blake was shot. A major protest took place on August 25th, 2020, the third night of demonstrations. Rittenhouse, age 17 at the time, lived in Antioch, Illinois, just over the Wisconsin border. On the third night of demonstrations, Rittenhouse joined a group of armed people claiming to attend the protest to protect businesses. Shortly before midnight, he was allegedly chased into a parking lot by Joseph Rosenbaum. A nearby man fired a gun. In video demonstrated Rittenhouse turning toward the sound of gunfire when Rosenbaum lunged at him. Rittenhouse fired four times, fatally shooting Rosenbaum in the head. Rittenhouse then fled with a crowd of at least 12 people in pursuit. He tripped and fell, firing at two of the pursuers, killing one and injuring the other. Rittenhouse was charged with first-degree intentional homicide, attempted first-degree intentional homicide, first-degree reckless homicide, two counts of reckless endangerment, and carrying a firearm illegally as a minor. Prosecutors later complicated the issue by calling for, quote, lesser included charges, end quote. The weapons charge was dismissed ahead of closing arguments. Rittenhouse claimed self-defense as justification for his actions. In closing arguments, prosecutor Thomas Binger showed video of a bystander asking Rittenhouse why he had shot Rosenbaum. Rittenhouse seems to respond that Rosenbaum pulled a gun. The prosecutor called that statement a lie the defendant told to save his own skin. Binger also said the state's case involves a 17-year-old killing two unarmed men and wounding a third person with an AR-15 that didn't belong to him. He argued that the video proves Rittenhouse provoked a Rosenbaum encounter, nullifying the defendant's self-defense claim. Kenosha County Circuit Court Judge Bruce Schroeder outlined 36 pages of instructions the jury is supposed to consider. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A recent survey of foster youths finds that group homes and other institutional care should be phased out in favor of in-home placements. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Group homes and large institutional foster care settings should be phased out. That's the recommendation of a recent report that surveyed youths in foster care. The youths interviewed for the Away From Home report complained of feeling vulnerable to further abuse with little privacy or personal connection. Report co-author Sixto Cancel with the nonprofit Think of Us says placement with relatives often is the best option as long as the child is consulted.
Let's actually ask young people who they would like to be placed with. Let's ask the family to be able to step up. We are still not actually maximizing aunts, uncles, cousins, grandma, grandpa.
California, which has 60,000 children in foster care, has been moving away from congregate care for years. The County Welfare Directors Association recommends more funding and that priority be given to recruiting new foster families. The state also committed $100 million in the most recent budget to help counties build facilities for foster youths with complex mental health needs. Sandra Gasca-Gonzalez is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Center for Systems Innovation. She applauds states like California, which have a dedicated ombudsman to handle allegations of abuse or neglect within the foster system.
The young people who were brave enough to make themselves loud and clear through the Away From Home report are telling us that now really is the time to hear them. They want us to hear their truth. They want us to heed their wisdom, and they want us to help them heal.
A 2020 study in the Journal of Children and Youth Services shows that an average of 1 in 5 foster care kids in the state will end up in congregate living. And according to the Children's Law Center, only 53% graduate high school on time. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview on why the war in Afghanistan was waged for so long, brought to us by KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1867, the first stock ticker is unveiled in New York City. The advent of the ticker ultimately revolutionized the stock market by making up-to-the-minute prices available to investors around the country. Prior to this development, information from the New York Stock Exchange, which has been around since 1792, traveled by mail or messenger. The quote of the day is from American civil rights activist and journalist Ida B. Wells, who said, quote, "The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them." Children's advocates are urging Congress to swiftly pass the Build Back Better Act, Part 2 of President Joe Biden's economic and infrastructure priorities. The measure includes provisions to allow more schools to give free meals to all students and extends summer meal assistance for students and women with infants and children that are enrolled in nutrition programs. Eric Galatis has the story.
This week, the U.S. House is expected to finally put the Build Back Better Act up for a vote, and children's advocates in Colorado are pushing the state's congressional delegation to advance a bill they say will ensure that more kids can access nutritious food. Ashley Whelan with Hunger Free Colorado says the measure would remove barriers to allow more schools to participate in free in-school and summer meal programs.
In Colorado, we've been left out a lot because our low-income kids are so dispersed around the state, but the provisions in the Build Back Better plan would make that a better option for more of the schools who do serve a larger percentage of low-income children.
Among other so-called soft infrastructure priorities, Build Back Better would expand the number of schools that offer free meals to all students and extend a program to help students who receive free or reduced-price school meals access food when school cafeterias close for the summer. Republicans and some Democrats oppose the measure, citing its close to $2 trillion price tag and concerns about rising national debt. Whelan notes that Build Back Better was designed to be fully paid for by closing tax loopholes for corporations and the wealthiest Americans. She says helping students access nutritious food year-round can help them overcome the educational, health, and economic impacts of the pandemic and put them on a path to become successful adults.
Kids need to not be hungry to learn. We're investing in our public education, and it's important that that education is working for all kids. So it's really important that we also ensure all kids have access to the food they need.
Build Back Better would provide $30 million for schools to upgrade kitchen equipment and $250 million to incentivize healthier meals. The measure also allows states and tribes that participate in nutrition programs for women, infants, and children to provide additional summer meal assistance. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Global climate talks end with mixed reviews. Vice President Harris tries to smooth tensions with France, and Biden is set to sign the bipartisan infrastructure deal. With more on these stories, we go to Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We must accelerate climate action to keep alive the goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. It's time to go into emergency mode.
COP26 closed with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres hailing the compromise it reached. About 200 countries adopted the Glasgow Climate Pact. They plan to return next year with updates on emission cuts by 2030 and climate financing for developing nations. President of the summit, Alex Sharma of Britain, was troubled that the agreement pledged to phase down coal, not phase it out, after opposition from China and India.
To all delegates, I apologize for the way this process has unfolded, I'm deeply sorry. I also understand the deep disappointment, but I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
Back here in the States, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other progressives argue the plan is not ambitious enough.
I don't think it's sunk in for a lot of people. A lot of people may not know this. We're living our day-to-day lives, but the stakes here are really huge.
Republicans question the agreement's impact on energy sector jobs with a move away from fossil fuels. Environmental groups are blasting a Biden administration plan to auction drilling rights in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil companies can bid Wednesday on nearly 80 million acres of federal waters that could produce a billion barrels of oil over 50 years. Opponents say Biden is breaking his pledge to ban new oil and gas leasing on public lands. Vice President Kamala Harris wrapped up a trip to Paris by placing flowers at a memorial to victims of a terror attack. She said the partnership between U.S. and France remains strong.
This trip was about, of course, making clear the longstanding relationship, but also that as we go into a new era for the world, that our work will continue, and we do it with a sense of optimism.
Harris sought to mend relations wounded when a submarine deal with Australia sidelined a prior deal with France. President Joe Biden will sign the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill today. 13 House Republicans joined most Democrats to pass the bill, while 6 Democrats and 200 Republicans were opposed. Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney, who helped negotiate the measure, weighed in on the lack of GOP support.
Some people thought, well, President Biden said he wanted to do something on a bipartisan basis. And so when we did something on a bipartisan basis, why, it looks like a victory for him. And some good Republicans say, I don't want to give him a victory.
Congress returns from break this week with the House focused on passing Biden's safety net, climate, and tax package. The Senate will shift its attention to the long overdue National Defense Authorization Act. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Conservationists worry that a proposed mine could result in damage to the carbon-rich peat soils in the Okefenokee Swamp on the Georgia-Florida border. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Along the Georgia-Florida border, the vast Okefenokee Swamp is home to alligators, tortoises, otters, and hundreds of fish and bird species.
There's rare species there that depend upon that system.
That's Rena Ann Peck of the Georgia River Network. She says the swamp is also important for the climate. It stores a huge amount of carbon in spongy peat soils that formed as plants decomposed over millennia. So her group and others have worked for years to protect the Okefenokee from mining, development, and other threats. Now they're fighting to prevent titanium mining near the swamp. They worry a proposed mine will reduce water levels in Okefenokee. That could harm wildlife and the climate. If peat is no longer submerged, microbes can break it down faster, and the decomposing peat can become a large source of CO2 emissions. And those emissions increase dramatically if the dried-out peat burns in a wildfire.
And these peat fires can burn for months. And if you think about 5,000 years of that organic matter disappearing, it's irreversible.
So damage to the Okefenokee could have impacts far beyond the swamp itself. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Biden administration announces steps to protect sacred sites in New Mexico, and Native American communities are overlooked in national economic discussions. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Biden administration is announcing steps to protect Chaco Canyon. Tribes have cultural, historical, and spiritual ties to the area in northwest New Mexico. Tribes in New Mexico and Arizona have long advocated for protection of the sacred area from development. Congress has passed legislation to temporarily put a hold on new leasing. President Biden is announcing that the Department of the Interior is taking steps to protect Chaco Canyon and the greater connected landscape. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland talked about the Interior Department's plan in a press call with reporters Sunday.
In the coming weeks after the president's announcement, the Department of the Interior will begin consideration of a 20-year withdrawal of federal lands within a 12-mile radius around Chaco Culture National Historical Park. They will protect the area from new federal oil and gas leasing and development. The proposed withdrawal will not apply to individual Indian allotments or to minerals within the area owned by private, state, and tribal entities.
The action will not restrict roads, water lines, and other similar developments. The Chaco Canyon announcement is part of the White House Tribal Nations Summit. Tribal leaders from across the country are taking part in the summit, which is being held virtually Monday and Tuesday. Monday's agenda is focused on policy panels on COVID-19, Native education and language, and public safety. President Biden, the First Lady, and Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland are kicking off the summit. Veterans Affairs and Agriculture are also topics Monday. Tuesday will feature more policy panels and remarks from officials. The latest federal jobs report paints a picture of some economic recovery, but as the Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports, Native Americans are overlooked in national economic discussions.
Nearly 40% of Native Americans saw cuts in work hours or pay over the last year. That's higher than all other racial or ethnic groups. These numbers are highlighted in a new Brookings Institution analysis. Raymond Foxworth is with First Nations Development Institute. He co-authored the report.
Native Americans as a group across the country were struggling economically before the pandemic. They had lower than average median incomes, suffered from high rates of unemployment and high rates of food insecurity.
Foxworth points out tribal leaders haven't been consulted about policies that affect them, and it's had a devastating impact. One solution is increasing federal support for Native communities. President Biden's relief packages have earmarked money for this, but Foxworth says given the historical underinvestment in tribal communities, there needs to be more. I'm Robin Vincent.
This summer, the Coquille Indian tribe lost its chief, Don Ivy, from cancer. Now a new leader has been sworn in, as KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Jason Yonkers, the University of Oregon's assistant vice president and advisor to the president on sovereignty and government-to-government relations, and will balance those duties as the new chief of the Coquille tribe based in Coos Bay. Yonkers says he'll be a voting member of the tribal council, which has many issues to address.
Global warming, because it affects the salmon, which are very precious to us, and pollution that also affects everything around us. We want our tribe and neighbors to be conscious of what took place on this landscape so that we have a historical context to learn from.
Yonker was cousin to Don Ivy, who died in July after a seven-month battle with cancer. Yonker says there's no one who can fill Ivy's shoes, and he regrets the circumstances that led to him taking over as chief. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 15th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatis, Suzanne Potter, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Galavan interviews photographer Carl Bauer about his show, Private Fears. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be hearing an interview about why the war in Afghanistan went on for so long. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Why did the war in Afghanistan last so long? Supposedly, President George W. Bush had just sent the troops in to destroy the Al-Qaeda bases in the country after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, but somehow the war kept on going. Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist and historian who spoke with KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. If the U.S. would have pulled out after those bases had been destroyed, David asked whether that would have been the end of the war.
I think it would have been, yes. And in large part because the way this war unfolded was not according to a grand plan that the U.S. Army or any other U.S. military organization had, but rather a whole series of sort of impromptu, unplanned responses to changes in the situation. I mean, there's a whole series of these. I don't want to get into, spend a lot of time on it, but just for example,